"We must have crossed the border hours ago," he said.
"Does that mean we're safe?" she whispered, and he could not bring himself to lie. She shivered. The night wind cut through their thin clothing. He unfolded the nylon ground sheet and spread it over her shoulders. Then he took her weight on his arm and led her on. A mile further on, they reached the far edge of the salt pan, and he knew she could go no further that night. There was a crusty bank 18 inches high, and then firm ground again.
"We'll stop here."
She sagged to the ground, and he covered her with the ground sheet.
Can I have a drink?"
"No, not until morning." The water canteen was light, sloshing more than half empty as he lowered the pack. He cut a pile of scrub to break the wind and keep it off her head, and then pulled off her jogging shoes, massaging her feet and examining them by touch.
"Oh, that stings."
Her left heel was rubbed raw. He lifted it to his mouth and licked the abrasion clean, saving water. Then he dripped mercurochrome on it and strapped it with a band-aid from the first aid kit. He changed her socks from foot to foot and then laced up her shoes again.
"You're so gentle,"
she murmured, as he slipped under the ground sheet and took her in his arms.
"And so warm."
"I love you," he said.
"Go to sleep."
She sighed and snuggled, and he thought she was asleep until she said softly,
"Craig, I'm so sorry about King's Lynn."
Then at last she did sleep, her breathing swelling deeply and evenly against his chest. He eased out from under the ground sheet and left her undisturbed. He went to sit on the low bank with the AK-47 across his knees, keeping the open pan under surveillance, waiting for them to come. While he kept the watch, he thought about what Sally Ann had said. He thought about King's Lynn. He thought of his herds of great red beasts and the homestead on the hill. He thought about the men and the women who had lived there and bred their families there. He thought about the dreams he had fashioned from their lives and how he had planned to do with this woman what they had done.
My woman.
He went back to where she lay and knelt over her to listen to her breathing. And he thought about her, spread naked and open on the long table, under the cruel scrutiny of many eyes. He went back to wait at the edge of the pan, and he thought about Tungata Zabiwe, and remembered the laughter and comradeship they had shared. He saw again the hand signal from the dock as they led Tungata away. "We are equal. The score is levelled." And he shook his head. He thought about once being a millionaire, and the millions he now owed. From a man of substance, he had been reduced in a single stroke to something worse than a pauper. He did not even own the bundle of paper in the British Airways bag. The manuscript would be forfeit. His creditors would take that also. He had nothing. Nothing except this woman and his rage. Then the image of General Peter Fungabera's face filled his imagination, smooth as hot chocolate, handsome as mortal sin, as powerful and as evil as Lucifer, and his rage grew within him until it threatened to consume him. He sat through the long night without sleep, hating with all the strength of his being. Every hour he went back to where Sally Ann slept and squatted beside her. Once he adjusted the ground sheet over her. Another time he touched the lump on her forehead lightly with his fingertips, and she whimpered in her sleep. Then he went back to his vigil. Once he saw dark shapes out on the pan, and his stomach turned over queasily. But when he put Timon's binoculars on them, he saw they were pale-coloured chemsbok, huge desert gazelle, large as horses, the diamond-patterned face masks that gave them their name showing clearly in the starlight. They passed silently upwind of where he sat and merged into the night. Orion hunted down the sky and faded at dawn's first glimmering. It was time to go on. But he lingered, reluctant to put Sally Ann to the terrors and the trials that day would bring, giving her just those last few minutes of oblivion. Then he saw them, and his guts and his loins filled with the molten lead of despair. They were still far out across the pan, a darkness too large to be one of the desert animals, a darkness that moved steadily towards him. The scrub brush that he had dragged must have been effective to delay them so long, but once he had abandoned it, they would have come on swiftly down the deeply trodden spoor. Then his despair changed shape. If it had to come, it might as well be now, he thought. This was as good a place as any to make their last stand. The Shona must come across the open pan, and he had the slight advantage afforded by the bank and the sparse cover of knee-high scrub, but little time in which to exploit them. He ran back to where he had left his rucksack, keeping doubled over so as to show no silhouette against the lightning sky. He stuffed the 5 grenades down the front of his shirt, snatched up the roll of wire and the side cutters, and hurried back to the edge of the bank. He peered out at the advancing patrol. They were in single file because the pan was so open, but he guessed they would spread out into a skirmishing line as soon as they reached the bank, adopting the classic arrowhead running formation that would give them overlapping cover and prevent them being enfiladed by ambush. Craig began to place his fragmentation grenades on that assumption. He sighted them along the top of the bank. That slight elevation would spread the blast out a little more. He wired each grenade securely to the stem of a bush, 20 paces apart, and then used a haywire twist to secure a single strand to each of the split pins that held down the firing handles. Then he led the strands back one at a time to where Sally Ann slept and secured them to the flap of his rucksack. He was down on his knees now, for the light was coming up strongly and the patrol was closer each minute. He readied the 5th and last grenade and this time wriggled back on his belly. The strands of wire were spread out fan-like from where he lay behind the screen of cut brush. He checked the load of the AK-47 and placed the spare magazines at his right hand. It was time to wake her. He kissed her softly on the lips, and she wrinkled her nose and made little mewing sounds. Then she opened her eyes, and love dawned green in them for an instant, to be replaced by dismay as she remembered their circumstances. She started to sit up, but he held her down with an arm over her chest. "They're here," he warned her. "I'm going to fight." She nodded. "Have you got Timon's pistol?" She nodded again, groping for it in the waistband of her jeans. "You know how to use it?"
"Yes."
"Keep one bullet for the end." She stared at him. "Promise you won't hesitate."
"I promise," she whispered.
He lifted her head slowly. The patrol was 400 yards out from the edge of the pan, and as he had guessed, they were already spreading into the arrowhead hunting formation. As they separated from a single amorphous blot in the poor light, he was able to count them. 5! His spirits dropped again sharply. Timon had not done as well as he had hoped for. He had culled only 3 of the original pursuit. 5 was too many for Craig. Even with all the advantages of surprise and concealment, it was just too many. "Keep your face down," he whispered. "It can shine like a mirror." Obediently, she dropped into the crook of her arm. He pulled up his shirt to cover his own mouth and nose and watched them come on. "Oh, God, they're good," he thought. "Look at them move. They've been going all night and they're still as sharp and wary as lynx." The point was a tall Shona who moved like a reed in the wind. He carried his AK-47 low on the right hip, and he was charged with a deadly intensity of concentration. Once the light of coming dawn caught his eyes, and they flashed like distant cannon fire in the blackness of his face. Craig recognized him as the main man. His drags, 2 on each side of him, were somber, stocky figures, full of dark menace and yet subservient to the man who led. They reacted like puppets to the hand signals that the tall Shona gave them. They came on silently towards the edge of the pan, and Craig arranged the wires across the palm of his left hand and ran them out between his fingers. 50 paces from the bank, the Shona stopped them with cut-out signals, and the line froze. The Shona's head turned slowly from side to side as he surveyed the low bank and the scrub beyond it. He took 5 paces forward, stepping lightly, and stopped again. His head turned once more, back and forth, and then back again. He had seen something. Craig instinctively held his breath as the seconds drew out. Then the Shona moved again. He swiveled and picked out his flanks, marked them with a stab of his forefinger, and then pumped a fist. Their formation changed into a reversed arrowhead. The Shona had adopted the traditional fighting formation of the Nguni tribes, the bull's horns that King Shaka had used to such terrible effect, and now the horns were moving to invest Craig's position. Craig felt a surge of relief at his own foresight in spreading the grenades so widely. The two flank men would walk almost on top of his outside grenades. He sorted the wires in his hand, taking up the slack and watching the flank men come on. He wished it had been the tall Shauna, the danger man, but he had not moved again. He was still way back out of blast range, watching and directing the flanking movement. The man on the right reached the bank and gingerly stepped up onto it, but the man on the left was still 10 paces out on the pan.
"Together," Craig whispered. "I've got to take them together."
The man on the bank must have almost brushed the hidden grenade with his knee as Craig let him overrun it. The man on the left reached the bank. There was a bloody bandage around his head. Timon's work. The grenade would be at about the level of his navel. Craig heaved with all his weight on the two outside wires and heard the firing handles fly off the grenades with a metallic twang, twang. 3 seconds delay on the primers, and the Shauna were reacting with trained reflexes. The man on the bank dropped from sight, but Craig judged he was too close to the grenade to survive. The three others, out on the pan, went down also, firing as they dropped, rolling sideways as they hit the crust, firing again, raking the top of the bank. Only the trooper out on the left, the wounded man, perhaps slowed by his injury, stayed on his feet those fatal seconds. The grenade exploded with the brilliance of a flashbulb, and the man was hit by fragmenting shrapnel. He was lifted off his feet as the blast tore into his belly. On the right, the other grenade burst in brief thunder, and Craig heard the taut, drum-like sound of shrapnel slapping into flesh.
"Two of the bastards," he thought, and tried for the tall Shauna. But his aim was through scrub and over the lip of the bank, and the Shauna was rolling.
Craig's first burst kicked white salt inches short, but on line, his second burst was a touch left, and the Shauna fired back and kept rolling. One of the other troopers jumped up and charged the bank, jinking like a quarterback with the ball, and Craig swung onto him. He hit him cleanly with a full burst, starting at the level of his crotch and pulling up across his belly and chest. The AK-47 was notorious for the way she rode up in automatic, and Craig had compensated for it. The trooper dropped his rifle and spun around sharply, fell onto his knees and then toppled forward on his face like a Muslim at prayer. The tall Shauna was up, coming in, shouting an order. The second man followed him, 20 paces behind. Craig switched his aim back again to him exultantly. He couldn't miss now. The AK-47 kicked once and then snapped on an empty chamber. The Shauna kept on coming, untouched. Craig was not as quick on the reload as he had once been. Just that microsecond too late, he swung back onto the Shauna, and as he squeezed the trigger, the man dropped out of sight below the rim of the bank, and Craig's burst flew high and harmless. Craig swore and swung left onto the last trooper, who was just 5 paces from the safety of the bank. It was snap-shooting, but a single lucky bullet out of the long burst hit him in the mouth and snapped his head back like a heavy punch. The burgundy-red beret, glowing like a pretty bird in the dawn light, flew high in the air, and the trooper collapsed. 4 out of 5 in the first 10 seconds. It was more than Craig could possibly have hoped for. But the fifth man, the danger man, was alive down there below the bank, and he must have marked Craig's muzzle flashes. He had Craig pinpointed.
"Keep under the sheet," Craig ordered Sally Ann,
and pulled the wires on the other three grenades. The explosions were almost simultaneous, a thunderous roll like the broadside of a man of war, and in the dust and flame Craig moved. He went forward and right, 30 running paces, doubled over, with the reloaded AK in his hand, and he dived forward and rolled and then waited, belly down, covering the spot below the bank where the Shauna had disappeared, but darting quick glances left and right. The light was better, the dawn coming up fast, and the Shauna moved. He came up over the bank, a brief silhouette against the white pan, quick as a mamba, but where Craig had not expected him. He must have elbow-walked under the bank, and he was way out on Craig's left. Craig swung the AK onto him, but held his fire. That quick chance wasn't good enough to betray his new position, and the Shauna disappeared into the low brush 50 paces away. Craig crawled forward to intercept, slowly as an earthworm, making no noise, raising no dust, and listening and staring with all his being. Long seconds drew out, slow as treacle, and Craig inched forward, knowing that the Shonar must be working towards where he had left Sally Ann. Then Sally Ann screamed. The sound raked his nerve ends like an emery wheel, and out of the brush they rose together, Sally Ann fighting and clawing like a cat, and the Shonar holding her by the hair, down on his knees, but holding her easily, turning with her to frustrate any chance of a shot. Craig charged. It was not a conscious decision. He found himself on his feet, hurling forward, swinging the AK-47 like a club. The Shonar saw him, released Sally Ann, and she staggered backwards and fell. The Shonar ducked under the swinging rifle and hit Craig in the ribs with his shoulder as he came off his knees. The rifle flew from Craig's hands, and he grappled, holding desperately, as he fought to regain the breath that had been driven out of him. The Shonar, realizing that his rifle was useless in hand-to-hand contact, let it fall and used both arms. Craig knew in that first moment of contact that the Shonar was simply too strong for him. He had height and weight, and he was trained to the hardness of black anthracite. He whipped a long arm around the back of Craig's neck, but Craig, instead of resisting, put all his own weight onto the direction of the Shonar's pull. It took him by surprise, and they cartwheeled. As he went over, Craig kicked out with the metal leg, but he didn't connect cleanly. The Shonar twisted and struck back at him. Craig smothered it, and they locked chest to chest, rolling first on top, then the other, flattening the coarse scrub, their breathing hissing into each other's faces. The Shonar snapped like a wolf at Craig's face with his square white teeth. If he had got a grip, he would bite off Craig's nose or rip his cheek away. Craig had seen it done before in beer hall brawls. Instead of pulling his head back, Craig butted forward with his forehead and hit him in the mouth. One of the Shonar's incisors snapped off at the gum, and his mouth glutted with blood. Craig reared back to butt him again, but the Shonar shifted over him, and suddenly he had the trench knife out of its scabbard on his belt. Craig grabbed at his wrist desperately, only just smothering the stab. They rolled, and the Shonar came out on top, straddling Craig, the knife in his right hand probing with the bright silver point for Craig's throat and face. Craig got both hands to it, one on the Shonar's wrist, the other into the crook of his elbow. But he couldn't hold him. The knife point descended slowly towards him, and the Shonar kicked his legs and locked one behind Craig's, pinning him like a lover. Down came the knife, and behind it the Shonar's face swollen with effort, his broken tooth pink with blood, blood running from his chin and dripping into Craig's upturned face, his eyes mottled with tiny brown veins, bulging from their sockets, and the knife came down. Craig put all his strength against him. The knife point checked for a second, and then moved down to touch Craig's skin in the notch where his collarbones met. It stung like a hypodermic needle as it pierced the skin. With a sense of horror, Craig felt the Shonar's body gathering for the final thrust that would force the silver steel through his larynx, and he knew that he could not prevent it. Miraculously, the Shonar's head changed shape, distorting like a rubber Halloween mask, collapsing upon itself, the contents of the skull bursting in a liquid fountain from his temple, and the sound of a shot dinned on Craig's eardrums. The strength went out of the Shonar's body, and he rolled off and flopped on the ground like a fresh-caught catfish. Craig sat up. Sally Ann was only feet away, kneeling, facing him, the Tukarev pistol held double-handed, the barrel still pointing skywards where the recoil had thrown it. She must have placed the muzzle against the Shonar's temple before she fired. "I killed him," she breathed gustily, and her eyes were filled with horror. "Thank God for it," Craig gasped, using the collar of his shirt to dry the nick on his throat. "I never killed anything before," Sally Ann whispered. "Not even a rabbit, nor a fish. Nothing." She dropped the pistol and started to dry wash her hands, scrubbing one with the other, staring at the Shonar's corpse. Craig crawled to her and took her in his arms. She was shaking wildly. "Take me away," she pleaded. "Please, Craig. I can smell the blood. Take me away from here." "Yes. Yes." He helped her to her feet, and in a frenzy of haste rolled the ground sheet and buckled the straps of the rucksacks. "This way." Burdened by both packs and the rifle, Craig led her away from the killing ground towards the west. They had been going for almost 3 hours and had stopped for the first sparing drink before Craig realized his terrible oversight. The water bottles. In his panicky haste, he had forgotten to take the water bottles from the dead Shauna. He looked back longingly. Even if he left Sally Ann here and went back alone, it would cost him 4 hours, and the 3rd Brigade patrols would surely be coming up. He weighed the water bottle in his hand, a quarter full, barely enough to see out this day, even if they laid up now and waited for nightfall and the cool. Not nearly enough if they kept going. And they had to keep going. The decision was made for them. The sound of a single-engined aircraft throbbing down from the north. Bitterly he stared up into the pale desert sky, feeling the helplessness of the rabbit below the towering falcon. "Spotter plane," he said, and listened to the beat of the engine. It receded for a while and then grew stronger again. "They're flying a grid search." As he spoke, he saw it. It was closer than he had thought and much lower. He forced Sally Ann down with a hand on her shoulder and spread the cape over her, glancing back as he did so. It was coming on swiftly, a low-winged, single-engine monoplane. It altered course slightly, heading directly towards him. He dropped down beside Sally Ann and crawled under the ground sheet beside her. The engine roared louder. The pilot had spotted them. Craig lifted a corner of the ground sheet and looked out. "Piperal ants," said Sally Ann softly. It carried Zimbabwe Air Force roundels, and incongruously the pilot was a white man, but there was a black man in the right-hand seat, and he wore the dreaded burgundy-red beret and silver cap badge. They both stared down expressionlessly as the Piper made a steep turn, and one wingtip pointed like a knife directly at where Craig lay. The black officer was holding the radio microphone to his lips. The wings of the Piper leveled, and she came out of her turn, heading back the way she had come. The throb of the engine receded and was lost in the desert silence. Craig pulled Sally Ann to her feet. "Can you go on?" She nodded, pushing back the sweat-damp wisp of hair from her forehead. Her lips were flaking, and the lower one had cracked through. A drop of blood sat on it like a tiny ruby. "We must be well inside Botswana. The border road can't be far ahead. If we can find a Botswana police patrol..."